Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Fixed Income Conversation Corner podcast series here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. We are joined today by Leslie Falconio, Head of Taxable Fixed Income Strategy for the Americas from the UBS Chief Investment Office. We're also excited to welcome his first appearance with us here on the series, Adam Block, Portfolio Manager, joining us today from Guggenheim. So with that, Adam, Leslie, thank you both for dropping by, spending some time today with our listeners, our clients. Leslie, let me now turn it over to you to lead today's conversation with Adam.
Thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate it. And Adam, I know you've been on some UBS podcasts before and some trending, but it's great to have you on, this series for the first time. And I'm really looking forward to getting your perspective, Guggenheim's perspective, particularly during a time where it has been tumultuous, to say the least. So thank you very much for joining. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Thanks for having me. I feel like I've made it to the big leagues making your podcast finally.
I appreciate that. Okay, so let's dive right in, because I'm sure you've been asked this question as well. I mean, I've been asked it many, many times. When we think about, since the end of February, right, that February 27th, when, growth was, slowing growth was in focus, private credit, AI disruption, 10-year treasury yields down to, say, a 3.94. And as we know, right after, we had the conflict in the Middle East, which caused a tremendous amount of volatility within risk assets, both on the fixed income and the equity side. 10-year goes to 4.48, and spreads widen. And lo and behold, the first week of April, we have the ceasefire, right? And then everything just, retracts. What I mean by that is the equity market makes new highs. We've got risk asset spreads compressing. Vol has come down. And everything kind of has gone, pre-crisis levels, one would say, except for treasury yields. And I know we're going to talk about that a little bit more later on in the podcast. But I have to ask you, how do you see this? First of all, what's your thought on this year-to-date performance that we've seen in spread product, number one? And number two, what do you think some of these drivers are going to be from now until year-end, particularly since, as I've mentioned, we've retraced a lot of that vol that we've seen in March?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I think I told you that a third of the way through the year or so, we'd have the S&P up 9%, the high yield index up almost 2%. We probably wouldn't have bothered to do a podcast on that. But, that obviously oversimplifies the year we've had. As you said, an enormous amount of under-the-surface volatility through the first four and a half months of the year. The dispersion in credit markets is particularly significant. You talked about some of the volatility we've seen in rates, and I imagine we'll talk a little bit more about that. But the software story alone, which, if you remember, was the kind of entire zeitgeist and concern right up until the start of the conflict in Iran. That if anything is just a reminder that active management matters. The security selection, industry selection on the software side, certainly within credit markets, but then risk management. If you had dry powder to deploy, really into anywhere other than interest rates during the onset of the war, that mattered an enormous amount. In terms of what will drive the rest of the year, keep an eye on Truth Social and Twitter posts, I suppose. But we think the conflict in the Middle East will continue to de-escalate. That likely will not be as simple or straightforward as we think the market is hoping. So we continue to expect volatility in oil markets, though that's largely going to remain a front end of the oil market type dynamic with longer, further out on the oil curve remaining relatively anchored. And then I mentioned earlier, but we do think the software concern is likely to come back up. We all got distracted by the Middle East, but the changing underlying dynamics in technology world, whether software or data center CapEx related, will continue to be very significant and will drive an enormous amount of issuance thinking about the data center side of things. So we think that'll create a lot of opportunities in credit going forward.
Well, let's touch upon that for a second, because I think that's a good point for a few reasons. Number one is that, remarkably, if we look at, let's say, your basic ICE Bank of America indices in terms of high yield and you know, IG. Spreads are kind of where we started the year, right? We're really having, they widened a little bit. Spreads kind of where we started the year. We've seen like things like the triple C index and high yield compress quite a bit. To your point, you know, while the software issue or the issue with private credit, I think is one of those that is, you know, dormant but not dead, but we still have senior loans coming back quite aggressively, you know, maybe probably because the market's, you know, put in that probability of a hike, not our call. But what is it that you think in terms of when you think about these spread levels that we're at, how do you think about them going forward? And you know, do you think that there's going to be volatility because of these geopolitical concerns, or is it just like it doesn't matter really where spreads are, let's compound the income?
Yeah, that last point is a good one. And, you know, as credit investors, we tend to almost exclusively focus on credit spread from a relative value perspective, and that is still how we kind of normalize the universe from a cross-sector perspective. But, you know, taking a broader view, what do investors care about? You care about your yield, and yields are still relatively high, even with spreads at relatively tight levels. And so, you know, you look at something like high-yield credit, and that makes that a pretty attractive asset class where you're, you know, really just thinking about what's my required rate of return to buffer me against defaults picking up or some sort of credit loss. So, you know, overall, we think we'll see likely a pretty benign credit environment for the next several months, several quarters even. You know, if you look kind of look historically, you get these risk flare-ups, event-based or otherwise, credit markets, you know, react. We didn't even really get that much of a reaction in the grand scheme of things this time around. And then following that reaction, so to speak, we tend to see, you know, pretty stable returns, you know, for the next several months or even several quarters, as I mentioned. So that's our kind of base case expectation. Last point I'll make is you know, you referenced spreads being relatively tight, and that's all index level data. But it does ignore or not acknowledge, I think, the fact that under the surface there can be quite a bit of dispersion. So, you know, we took a look at, and we're very active in the insurance industry space within IG corporates during the month of March. You know, you had obviously coming off the back of the software concerns and the BDC market concerns that translated over into private credit held on insurance company balance sheet concerns. And we saw some spread widening in some of the larger life insurance names. That provided some good opportunity to be a little more tactical, you know, even taking a relatively beta neutral position there, but, you know, having some strong opportunity for industry and security selection. So even with spreads kind of at or near the tights in credit markets, there's still, given the volatile backdrop from a number of different perspectives, there's a lot to do to generate alpha under the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really good point as well, particularly when you look at the insurance side or, you know, some of those issues that have experienced a little bit more of supply headwinds than others. But as we talk about sort of like the spreads, let's switch to another performance driver in fixed income. Let's talk about, say, just the 10-year treasury. Now, one of the things that I had mentioned is that we have this retracement that occurred since the ceasefire that took a lot of these spreads, you know, back to pre-conflict levels. But the one thing that has stayed, that hasn't gone back, is the level of interest rates, and particularly that of the 10-year treasury. Now, we know there's some performance drivers due to that, whether it's inflation or the Fed putting, you know, or the market saying, no, Fed, you're not going to cut, you're going to hire for longer, or you might even hike. But how do you think of this 10-year treasury, even though it stayed relatively in a you know, I would consider it range-bound, what is your forecast for the 10-year as we sort of look at some of these performance drivers for fixed income, both high quality and more credit-embedded sectors?
Yeah, you kind of took the words right out of my mouth, or our firm view, which is range-bound. And it's not perhaps the most interesting view, but it does give us a number of pretty good investment implications. So kind of big range we've been talking about, 3.75 to 4.75 on 10s. Realistically, we're playing that more in a 4 to 4.5% range. So across the board, we did reduce duration back at at the very end of February, as you mentioned earlier, when 10s went under 4%, began adding back duration as we kind of marched closer to 4.5% back in back towards the end of March. And so, you know, these are, we kind of chalk this up to like hitting of singles, not swinging for the fences. So small little adjustments around the edge of those ranges. But the kind of macro backdrop, you know, you mentioned with the de-escalation in Iran, normalizing credit markets and risk markets pretty quickly. You know, the same has not been the case for the rates market, and largely it is inflation driven, or concerns around inflation driven, simply because the oil market is not able to rebound nearly as quickly, which is certainly, you know, largely in part because the Strait of Hormuz is still not reopened. And as we've seen, the kind of fits and starts of trying to reopen it have been quite challenged and contested on both sides. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we're likely to see oil remain very volatile, and that'll keep at least uncertainty around inflation high. Which means term premium is likely to remain elevated, and as a result, in nominal longer-term inflation rates should remain relatively elevated. But what's interesting, though, you know, if you think about what oil does to inflation, that's all headline inflation. That's CPI. The Fed's mandate is core PCE, so, you know, ex food and energy, and with a slightly different weighted basket than CPI. Our work has headline CPI going up by 0.9% or so based on our forecast for oil remaining elevated here for some time, but core PCE really only going up by about 0.1%. So this should not be a terribly inflationary impact for the things the Fed is officially supposed to care about, but at the very least, it will remain very difficult for them to kind of get back on the rate cutting path in the next couple meetings, barring you know, an immediate resolution of the conflict, which doesn't really seem that likely right now. So, long-winded way of saying the upward pressures on rates due to inflation are probably overstated, but at the same time, not likely to have significant downward pressures anytime soon. So again, that range-bound thesis should hold.
So, you know, I want to expand on that a little bit, and you partly, you know, alluded to it. Let's first start with just the Fed for a minute, and you know, the CPI and PCE differentiation and what the Fed and the core versus headline is noted. But, you know, at the end, you know, even when, if there is a resolution, say 2 weeks from now, you know, the floor on oil prices is going to be much higher than what the pre-conflict level was, right? So we have to, that we also know that, you know, whether it's, you know, gasoline or whatever it might be, fertilizer, all these kinds of things are going to at some point move through the economy. It doesn't necessarily have to be in complete, you know, consumer demand destruction. But how do you think the Fed sort of looks at this through year end, particularly since things like CPI, to your point, you know, may not be that much of an overshoot, but it has been above their target for several years. So how do you think about the Fed in terms of what the policy path will be from now to the end of the year?
So officially, we have an expectation for one cut by the end of the year. I would say more realistically, that one cut is like an average of a 50% chance of no cuts and a 50% chance of two cuts. The no cuts is, you know, simply because we'll have very elevated noise and volatility around the conflict, and as a result, a knock-on effect for inflation. The two cut side of it, though, is, you know, we are seeing significant widening in the labor market or bifurcation in the labor market, the so-called K-shaped economy that we all read about and talk about. And so, you know, we think absent this war in Iran, the Fed would be primed to be cutting, you know, immediately or would have already cut once this year to try to ease the pressure on the labor market and the pressure on lower income households. But the kind of confusion thrown into it, and to your point, we haven't seen, you know, choose your favorite inflation measure, but we haven't seen any of them come down significantly enough in line with the Fed's goals. So, you know, it does make it a tougher case for them to be cutting. The other thing that's obviously interesting is the changing of the guard at the Fed. And with Warsh coming in, Powell not quite leaving the chair position, but not leaving the Fed in totality. You know, Warsh probably won't be able to be as dovish as Trump had hoped, given the war. but at the same time, you know, Warsh was kind of more of a balance sheet hawk and inclined to tighten up the balance sheet. That'll also probably be difficult for him to do. Just some of the mechanics, some of the other composition of the Fed. So we think it's likely Fed-wise going to be kind of business as usual, whatever that means, but not an enormous amount of change between now and the end of the year. And then, you know, 2027 should mean the Fed's able to kind of start to get back on the rate cutting path. But obviously, there's, you know, we've got to wind down a war and see how labor market data evolves over the next, the remainder of the year before we get to that point.
Yeah, I mean, you hit on the Warsh transition, and you know, I'm going to comment on that for a second. But, I mean, CIO, we have actually two cuts this year at, you know, very towards the back end of the year. But, you know, to your point, we don't have the highest conviction on that, right? Because it is, as you mentioned, it's going to be very fundamentally driven. We just don't know what the outcome is. We don't know how long the ceasefire is going to last. But, you know, I think what we can say with conviction, whether it's at September or December or just December, we feel very confident that the next move will be a cut, not a hike. And I think that is really what the important talent is. And as you mentioned, Warsh, I just want to talk about that for a second as it relates to particularly some of the, you know, Basel III and some of the, you know, capital reforms have been proposed. But, you know, our view is similar to yours in terms of transition to Warsh. I mean, he might have these ideas of either lowering the balance sheet, although there's a big difference between lowering the balance sheet amount and just changing the composition. And we just don't feel it's going to be something that is going to be addressed for quite some time. So we agree with that. But one of the things that you can do to try and help on the reserve side is, you know, lower bank regs, right? So how do you kind of look at, you know, this Basel III? Or what are your thoughts on this? Do you think it's something that, you know, has legs to it going forward? Do you think that, how do you think this impacts sort of like the market? And more importantly, because I know you and I believe are both fans of the securitized side, particularly the agency MBS, what does this mean for, say, bank demand?
Yeah, so evolution or the most recent evolutions of Basel III Endgame, we think are very positive, you know, both from a philosophical normative perspective, but also from a market perspective, particularly the narrowing of the scope to really just G-SIBs is important as you think about the health of kind of tier two and then regional banks. And then the enhancements that have been made to mortgage provisions are also moving in the right direction. So specifically, the update to no longer deduct mortgage balances or mortgage holdings from Tier 1 capital should do a lot to open up the bank activity there and really reduce the shifting of mortgage origination to non-bank lenders, which seems to be an overall goal of regulators. So that should be positive for the MBS market if and when it comes to fruition. You know, we are, in terms of how we think about the direct impact on the mortgage market, we have a very positive fundamental and technical view from a couple different perspectives on the mortgage market, which we can talk about. Not baked into that, or the bank demand increasing is not baked into those views. So we kind of view it as icing on the cake if bank demand starts to ramp up. And in conversations with a number of banks, you know, that we transact with and their treasury departments, you know, we do get the sense that they are kind of readying the firepower to ramp up their securitization books in the mortgage market. But it's not something where, given the kind of fits and starts we've had on Basel III Endgame over the past several years, it's not something we're ready to fully dive into from a investment thesis perspective, but the kind of trajectory or possibility is really only positive if that does come to fruition for the mortgage market.
So when we think about, I mean, I know that, you know, one of our positioning has been, you know, to be long sort of that agency MBS side. And you know, look, they've had, last year was a great year for them. Finally, they started to kick in, right? It was a long time coming because they had really underperformed the year prior versus a lot of the compression that we saw in some of their credit card parts, such as IG corporates. But, you know, we are long agency MBS. You know, we like them here in terms of the carry of current coupon, the, you know, the fact, obviously, the move from 5.98 at the end of mortgage, 30-year mortgage rate at the end of Feb to, say, a 6.40-ish that we got in March and April has, you know, waned that, you know, refinance, if you will, right? Even though a lot of consumers are locked in at much lower rates. But so what are your views on agency MBS? Do you think, I mean, some people think that they're a bit tight here. Some people are, you know, preferring the IG corporates over agency MBS simply because of their correlation to equity and the supply is already priced in. They believe on the IG side. And it's not like we don't like IG corporates. We do. We just really like the agency MBS side as a great diversification within a fixed income portfolio structurally and in terms of performance drivers. But I'm curious for your thoughts.
Yeah, so I mentioned kind of a couple theses here that all triangulate around us also being very positive and overweight on MBS kind of across the board. So one, we talked about earlier, but the range bound rate hypothesis or thesis means that refis or prepayments should remain relatively low. If you don't think tens are going meaningfully below 4%, you know, that's really not enough of a move in the mortgage rate to incentivize a significant amount of refi. On the other hand, because you still have interest rate volatility that's somewhat elevated, you know, typical mortgage prepayment models are expecting a higher degree of prepayments than what we expect. So that means we feel like we can take risk and add exposure in current coupon mortgages and effectively get paid to take that refi risk that we don't think will actually end up coming to fruition. So what that means is, if you look at the kind of static spread, which doesn't really assume much in the way of prepayments, you're getting paid 100, 120 over the 10-year Treasury on current coupon mortgages, at a time when on the IG market you're inside 80 over. So to your point, you know, it's not necessarily a negative view on IG outright, but from a relative perspective, we think the agency mortgage market looks quite a bit more attractive. And then you throw on whether it's bank demand increasing or, as you know, if we remember back to the beginning of the year, Trump's mandate for the GSEs to buy $200 billion of mortgages that, as far as we can tell, hasn't happened at all. That's another potential shoe to drop that, you know, particularly as we approach the midterm elections that don't seem to be looking great for President Trump's party at the moment. The shift towards affordability might bring that $200 billion purchase mandate back into the spotlight.
So I do want to ask you, like, and please feel free to, you know, talk about various sectors that, you know, you feel offer great relative value opportunity for our advisors and clients, whether it's munis or preferreds or high yield, whatever it might be. But where are you, what do you think overall the positioning should be, you know, in this current environment? Like, what would you like to highlight? But I also want to ask you, too, as I always ask this as final thoughts, what is one of the things that the wall of worry that you have, right? Because I want it to be like, what you think is undervalued that really has the opportunity to have great tailwind to a total return. But also, I'm curious, as one of the things that you might be worried about in the sense that, you know, the market's gotten a little bit too far over its skis with some of this retracement.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll start with what we like, and then we can end on the negative note of the wall of worry, I suppose. But the kind of trailing off the agency MBS discussion, there's a lot of areas of non-agency structured credit that also look very attractive, particularly in the non-agency RMBS residential mortgage-backed security market. You know, those two markets, agency and non-agency resi, are pretty linked to each other. There's enough crossover buyers that kind of police the spread or the basis between the two of those pretty significantly. But then there's parts of the non-agency RMBS market that aren't particularly interest rate sensitive. So a couple areas we really like are securitizations of HELOCs, home equity lines of credit, or second lien mortgages. And these aren't the second liens or HELOCs of the financial crisis. These are people who are locked into their, you know, 50 LTV, 3% type mortgage, who want to take out a little bit of equity to get maybe back to a cumulative 60 or 65% LTV on the house. Put that money back in to do a renovation, build an addition, you know, find some way to feel like they can stay in the house without giving up their mortgage. And these are typically 750 or higher FICO borrowers. So it's very much a different credit profile than the, you know, 05, 06 HELOC market. But these are not terribly interest rate sensitive collateral underlying. Rates move 50 bips, you're not going out and refining your HELOC. You're needing quite a bit more to move the needle there. So, but as rates rose and an interest rate vol widened, or interest rate vol rose, we saw spreads widen, and that happened in interest rate sensitive, prepay sensitive sectors, but also less prepay sensitive subsectors. So that has also been an interesting area for us to play. And then in ABS, we continue to be very active in the aircraft ABS market as global travel continues to rebound and supply remains relatively constrained given Boeing's issues, some of the tariff-related the frustrations, I guess, Airbus has run into. New plane production remains very low at a time when consumer demand remains very high. And so the kind of activity in that market as a result has created some really interesting unique opportunities for us. But overall, we are finding a lot of value in a lot of different parts of the structured credit markets, whether RMBS, ABS, even parts of the CLO market, given the turbulence we've had in private credit markets. And then what's the wall of worry? I think the issuance trends in the technology space are concerning. Not necessarily overly concerning, but something to be very cognizant of and pay attention to. You know, we've been very active in financing of data center warehouses in ABS and CMBS markets over the past several years, kind of when it, you know, going back 3-4 years when it was more of a cottage industry within structured credit. And now that market is blowing up, in terms of issuance. So we're seeing ABS markets get tapped, CMBS, IG private placements, IG tradable, now high yield tradable, all to finance data centers. And listen, the need for compute is likely to continue to grow. We all are obviously seeing AI improve our workflows and productivity, both personally and professionally. So we don't see that stopping. But as with any commercial real estate cycle or commercial real estate buildup, you're at risk of seeing a cycle at some point. And so we're being, we think, pretty thoughtful and conservative in how we deploy capital into the technology and data center buildup. But it's something keeping a close eye on.
Right. Well, listen, Adam, this has been I'm so glad that you came on. I hope this kickstarted several more podcasts with you to come. This was a great conversation. I'd love to hear about, you know, Guggenheim, what they're thinking and their allocation. So thanks very much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.